You know, normally at this point in the program, I make a few comments, mention some news, tease upcoming events, but we're putting those things on hold until later in the broadcast. I have two guests joining us in the first 2 hours tonight, and we have so much to cover with both of them that I want to get right to it. We do have some special listeners out there this evening, people who aren't usually up this late and tuned in, and I might mention them later. And in the second half tonight, a much different topic, the essence, origin, and face of evil. But first, you know, like many of you, I was greatly encouraged when the New York Times busted out with its front page blockbuster story a couple of months ago about a secret Pentagon program to study UFOs. I mean, it didn't exactly come as a surprise, and by that I mean many who follow the UFO issue have assumed that the military must be keeping track of some of these incidents, certainly the cases that involve intrusions over secure facilities or interactions with military units. But we really didn't know where those case files ended up. It had not been confirmed until a man named Luis Elizondo stepped forward to say he'd been the Pentagon's point man, the guy running the program. The acronym is ATIP, Advanced Aerospace Threat Identification Program. Elizondo made his public debut of sorts alongside musician Tom DeLonge and other notables back in October when DeLonge announced the creation of his To the Stars Academy. The Time story came out a little bit later, and then an explosion of media coverage for a few days at least. I think we were all hopeful it would lead to more revelations and continuing coverage by news organizations, and then poof, seems like it vanished. The media stopped covering the story, and as usual, the UFO crowd pounced all over it, pummeling it from every direction. It's fake, it's phony, it's disinformation, it's a plot, it's a cabal, it's Pentagon puppet masters, yada, yada, yada. Pretty much the same way that UFO poobahs react every time there's new information from someone other than themselves. Tonight, we go back to square one. What was the program designed to do? How did it begin? Who was involved? And what did they learn? As I've said before, when it comes to big news stories, it seems like all roads lead to Las Vegas, my hometown. And yes, I do happen to know a lot of the central players in this ongoing adventure. Two of them are my guests in the first half of this program tonight. Both are brilliant physicists who've served their country in many capacities. Both were involved with BAS, that's the private organization created by Robert Bigelow to serve as the contractor for the ATIP study. In fact, both of these guests had worked with Bigelow before as part of his previous organization, the National Institute for Discovery Science, NIDS, which in some ways served as a model for BAS. You still with me? In hour two, we'll be joined by Dr. Hal Puthoff. He's an internationally known physicist who's done cutting-edge work on space propulsion, energy research, cosmology, is one of the fathers of remote viewing and ESP studies conducted for the government. I've wanted to get Hal on the show since the first day I joined COAST, and tonight it happens. He was not only part of NIDS and BAS and ATIP, but is now one of the board members and partners in Tom DeLonge's To the Stars Academy. But first, Dr. Eric Davis is here. He works with Hal Puthoff at the Institute for Advanced Studies in Austin. He has his own distinguished background in the study of cutting-edge physics subjects, and he too was involved with NIDS and BAS, studying UFOs and other unexplained phenomena, including time spent on Skinwalker Ranch. Eric returns to the program for the first time since 2006. Been way too long. We have a lot of ground to cover, as I mentioned, and not enough time to do it, so I'm just going to get right down to business. In just a moment, Dr. Eric Davis, the scientific study of UFOs. I'm George Knapp, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Dr. Eric Davis is the Chief Science Officer of EarthTech International and the Institute for Advanced Studies at Austin. Dr. Davis' research specializations include breakthrough propulsion physics for interstellar flight, and SETI xenoarchaeology. He worked with NIDS and BAS, as I mentioned, in the study of UFOs and other phenomena, and he's a brilliant guy. Eric, it's great to have you back.
Hi, George. Thank you for having me on, and I'm really sorry it's taken this many years to make a return visit.
We won't wait that long for your next visit. Let's start sort of with BAS and then work our way backwards. You were a subcontractor to BAS, which is sort of the civilian contractor for the ATIP study by the Pentagon. Can you tell us what you did as part of that?
Yeah, basically, Hal and I were consultants to the Department of Defense ATIP program and BAS itself. We basically let me get through here and explain what the elements of the program are. The program was initiated, as you know, by a group of key senators. They were led by then Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid and Republican Alaskan Senator Ted Stevens and Democrat Senator Daniel Inouye from Hawaii. And they were concerned about the AAV threat, that's the Advanced Aerospace Vehicles. And more precisely, these were vehicles that were under intelligent control and they were of unknown origin. The usual typical forensic investigation, scientific investigation process of elimination eliminated these things as they were not, in other words, they were eliminated from the possibility of being either a known or unknown natural phenomenon, space or atmospheric, as well as being eliminated as possible man-made phenomenon. They were unknown. They did not match any of the possibilities that could attribute them to either a natural phenomenon or a man-made phenomenon. So these were craft of an unknown origin. So a congressional mandate was issued. And the problem with the study of this topic is it suffers from over-compartmentalization in the Pentagon and a lack of apparent cumulative progress and integration across all the components of the Department of Defense, and it also lacked clarity in both the known public and classified programs below top secret. And so the proposed solution to this problem was to increase horizontal integration of present and future investigations with access to known research spanning both classified and classified materials. And so basically the idea was to have the DOD set up a broad area announcement to announce a request for bids from defense contractors, and the announcement basically laid out the mission statement, the goals that were hopefully, you know, that were expected to be accomplished under the contract and milestones associated with the goals, and everybody would then have a list of all the specific information given in the announcement that would give them enough information to be able to write a contract proposal and submit it by the deadline. And so BAS was one of the number of contractors that submitted a bid, and they got the contract. They won the award. And so that's how BAS got that contract. And it was funded under congressional appropriation through the Department of Defense, one of the many programmatic line items in their authorization and in their appropriations spending bills. So the nature of the threat of the AAV is considered twofold. Basically, the present threat associated with the AAV source phenomena, some possibility, you know, we consider it off-world based. It's possible also that there was probably foreign derivation of advanced technology being globally deployed and tested, including within the United States. But as I said, we went through the forensic and scientific process of elimination on the evidence that has been gathered, and the arrows all pointed toward non-human origin, non-natural phenomenon. So it was more of the anomalous unknown origin source for this, as opposed to being either domestic U.S. or foreign technology that's being derived, that's being flown around and interacting or interfering with our military operations. But anyway, so the second part of that is the future threat was also associated from potential terrestrial adversaries who might make breakthroughs in the development of game-changing disruptive technologies based on evaluations of the AAV phenomenon via sensor data and AAV crash retrieval materials. So that was the twofold nature of the threat that was considered in the program. So it was all put together and structured so that we could look at this in a holistic data fusion way. And so BAS was organized as BAS, B-A-A-S-S, Big Lure Aerospace Advanced Space Studies, was a a division of Bigelow Aerospace, privately owned. And as you already know, and I don't have to repeat this to you too many times, you know that Bigelow Aerospace is now a major player in the privatization of space. So they...
Tell me this, Eric. So it gets set up within Bigelow Aerospace, BAS, and BAS is interacting with the DIA. They put out the contract. Do you get to see reports that come from, I know my understanding of it is that BAS sort of cast a wide net. They're building a big database of UFO cases, collecting a lot of information. Does that include reports from the Pentagon? And did you get to see any?
But that wasn't all of it. We saw reports from the Pentagon. We saw field studies from the former NIDS Utah Ranch, which was just now the ranch that was owned by Bigelow Aerospace up in northeast Utah in Fort Duchesne. And basically, any other commercial pilot report, general aviation pilot report, military pilot report, any other military component that had an encounter with UFOs, had sensor data measurements of it or recordings of it, along with eyewitness accounts, these things would be investigated, reports would be generated, and it would all be funneled to BAS. And BAS had established a relationship with the Federal Aviation Administration so that if there were pilot reports on UFOs coming in, then those reports were to be collected by the FAA from the pilots and sent to BAS. So that was one of the things. So the idea was to collect the data and analyze it. And EarthTech's part of that, or IASA's part of that, part of the program, was basically just scientific advice, looking at data, making recommendations. We did not do data analysis per se. That was going on in-house at BAS. So we weren't associated with the actual data analysis or video analysis or witness report analysis or any of that stuff. That was all done in-house at BAS. We would just provide scientific oversight. And what we did is we were tasked to look into the future, probably about 2050, and we were to set up a series of expert studies that would end up being reported in the form of Defense Intelligence Reference Documents, DIRD, or DIRDs. And so what we were asked to do would be to look at a category of a variety of topics that could be researched by experts in the field of the topic, have them write a DIRD report, and the idea is for the authors to look into the future in about 2050 and imagine on the extrapolation of existing physics, material science, and technology and engineering, what we can accomplish in the way of the technology in 2050 that could most closely reproduce the physical characteristics of the AAVs that are observed by the military pilots and general aviation and commercial airline pilots and other people.
So Eric, it's not so much, hey, are these aliens from the planet Meepsorp? It's to figure out how do these things work and can we build them?
That's the whole point. That's what I'm basically saying. So we had topics like lift, propulsion control, power generation, spatial temporal translation, material science, configuration and structure, signature reduction, human effects, human interface and armament, and peripheral support. So those are the topics that were looked at. And we had we had 38 of these expert papers. Two of them were classified and 36 were unclassified. And they covered some very interesting topics. Like I did a paper on anti-gravity for all space applications. Somebody did superconductors and gravity research. Somebody else did positron aerospace propulsion. I did another paper co-authored with a colleague of mine on warp drive, dark energy, and extra dimensions. And a colleague of ours who was a former PhD student of Werner Heisenberg did a paper on advanced nuclear propulsion. We had a paper on brain-machine interfaces, another one based on MEMS-based biosensors, another one based on IEC fusion as a compact energy source, and I can go down the list. There's 38 of these things. And so we were looking at advanced, really what's the best state-of-the-art of our advanced knowledge in a whole broad category or an umbrella of categories of topics And we were looking into 2050 to try to find out, can we match the AAV with human technology? And so that was the purpose of these reports. And so that's what Hal and I pretty much did a large part of our work on during the BAS era.
You were not surprised when the New York Times story came out because you knew the study had been in existence, were aware that it ended when it ended. Were you surprised, though, by the subsequent media reaction that was such a really big deal, and were you encouraged by it?
I was not surprised because I had heard that this story was coming out. I was surprised somewhat by the media reaction. I think you had more positive reaction or feedback from the various news outlets than you had negative. And as you know, I've been interviewed for this, and for example, I'll have my view as an insider on the outcome of this program and its efficacy and its success. And then you're going to have the journalist is going to have to, who has to maintain the requirement for balance. He's going to have the negative view or the opposing viewpoint put in by finding some other, by finding somebody out there who's an expert who will have a completely different opinion on, you know, this whole subject. So you might have Jim Ober opine, lately we've been seeing the very highly banal Seth Shostak, who is the director of the SETI Institute. And Seth is one of the favorite skeptical voices out there. He says the stupidest things I've ever heard. He obviously doesn't understand how F-18 fighters and Raytheon FLIRs operate. he was saying stuff that was patently ridiculous as a complaint that the pilots were chasing light reflected in their cockpit windshield and things like that. And it's not possible to keep the target centered in the view screen of the monitor in the cockpit. Or the FLIR monitor.
Well, we'll get into that in a little bit on the other side of the break that's coming up. Yeah. But, you know, I saw a lot of these interviews on various cable news programs, and they trot the same scientists out who say the amazing conclusion they reach is, you know, the U in UFO stands for unidentified. No kidding. Wow. What a revelation.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's become a dirty word. So we got away from UFO and now it's AAVs. Linda Howe interviewed me on her Phenomenon Radio a couple weeks ago. And, you know, it's really wonderful to talk to her. Hal and I have had dinner with her years ago here in Austin. And we really enjoy spending time and interacting with her and answering her questions and whatnot. And she goes by UAP, Unidentified Aerial Phenomenon. And that's something I think you yourself have used a lot. So, yeah, it's unidentified. But unidentified doesn't mean it's natural phenomenon, whether space-related or geophysical. It's not man-made. We're talking about objects here that let me read to you this. You don't know what this is. This is the key assessment in one of the 36, about three dozen investigation reports on the November 2004 Nimitz carrier strike group encounter.
I'll tell you what, Eric, we are going to a break in about 30 seconds, so maybe hold that until the other side. I want to hear it. As in the 30 seconds we have left, you know, the reaction from ufology, are you surprised by that? I would think it's been so hostile. It's a cover-up. It's disinformation. Yeah. The UFO videos are fake. What are you guys up to? Why don't they tell us more? Show us the alien body as immediately, or we're going to hold our breath. I mean, That's not entirely unexpected either, is it?
No, the ufologist, let me point out to you what I know about European ufologist view of American ufologists. The Europeans believe that, or they view the American ufology as a complete joke because of the way American ufologists behave and how they think and what their cognitive dissonance rules, or how it rules their way of thinking on this subject. It's terrible. And they're more scientific in Europe. They're more cautious. They're neutral. They're not given to hype and conspiracy and speculation. They work to do the science. They work to do the forensic science and the forensic investigations on this phenomenon. They're not interested in conspiracy theories or, you know, rail or who there is a part of a cabal or an Illuminati.
All right. We're talking with Dr. Eric Davis about the ATIP and BAS study of UFOs. When we come back, he's going to get into some of the specific goals of the research and what they found out. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. We're talking with Dr. Eric Davis about the secret UFO study conducted by the Pentagon through a contractor, BASS. And as Eric just told us, that organization produced a number of classified reports, but also unclassified reports, which makes you wonder, can we ever get to see them? One report, one focus of the Pentagon study was an incident or series of incidents from November of 2004. It occurred a couple years before the study began, involving the USS Nimitz carrier group off the coast of Southern California. Radar operators over a period of a couple of days kept picking up these strange returns of these objects that would zip in from about 80,000 feet down to hover 50 feet over the water. They sent out a couple of F-18s to check it out and recorded some amazing video. You've probably seen that video. When we come back, we're going to hear Eric Davis give us his take on what was discovered about that. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. Dr. Eric Davis worked with BASS on the ATIP Pentagon UFO study. Before that, he was with NIDS and spent a lot of time on Skinwalker Ranch. I hope we'll get a chance to talk about that a little bit. Eric, before the break, you were going to tell us a little bit about the some of the specifics of the study.
Yeah. Basically, let me read to you the key assessments. This is the combined key assessments of the F-18 pilots that were flying out of the Nimitz who encountered the Tic Tac. The anomalous aerial vehicle was no known aircraft or air vehicle currently in the inventory of the United States or any foreign nation. The anomalous aerial vehicle exhibited advanced slow observable characteristics at multiple radar bands, rendering U.S. radar-based engagement capabilities ineffective. The anomalous aerial vehicle exhibited advanced aerodynamic performance with no visible control surfaces and no visible means to generate lift. The advanced aerial vehicle, anomalous aerial vehicle exhibited advanced propulsion capability by demonstrating the ability to remain stationary with little to no variation in altitude, transitioning to horizontal and or vertical velocities far greater than any known aerial vehicle with little to no visible signature. And the anomalous aerial vehicle possibly demonstrated the ability to cloak or become invisible to the human eye or human observation. And last, the anomalous aerial vehicle possibly demonstrated a highly advanced capability to operate undersea, completely undetectable by our most advanced sensors. So, you see, this doesn't match anything that can be explained away as a natural phenomenon or a man-made phenomenon. This is clearly forensic evidence, it's facts, it's data, and that's what it is. And it's a shame that the American UFO community ties itself up into a horrid knot of conspiracy theory, hoaxes, cabals, the videos are fake, the government is putting out disinformation or misinformation, the government's playing the game, that's a practical joke, et cetera, et cetera. I could go on with all the different possibilities that have been expressed so far. It's very bizarre. In the 1970s and 80s, the UFO community would basically say, please give us this data, we would like to analyze it. That's all they would say. And then in 21st century American ufology, we've got nut cases. It's just really sad.
Eric, can I go back a little bit to how a guy like you gets involved in these topics? Because, you know, you're a mainstream scientist. You're on the cutting edge of a lot of interesting stuff. So many of your colleagues wouldn't come near this. And yet you sign up to work with Bob Bigelow and his crew at NIDS. You end up on Skinwalker Ranch. It seems like a lot of people in your line of work wouldn't want to come within a mile of that kind of research.
Well, I didn't quite know that that's what I was getting into, but it fit my life anyway, because my wife and I had a UFO encounter in 1989, May of 1989, at my PhD supervisor's house during a summer swimming party that he hosted for all of the graduate students in our department. I was doing my PhD dissertation on the Voyager missions to Jupiter, and so I was working specifically on the Io plasma torus, doing the plasma dynamics in my thesis, in my dissertation research. And so there were other students there that worked for my professor and other students that worked for the other professors in the research group. This was at the extreme ultraviolet spectrometer group which was part of the Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 EUV instrument development group, which was based at the Lunar and Planetary Laboratory in the Planetary Sciences Department at the University of Arizona in Tucson. And so one fine day in May, we're having a swimming party in the back of my dissertation supervisor's house, and my wife and I saw a UFO, and it was a black boomerang-shaped object in broad daylight. It had four square, really neon bright lights in the inset of the rear of it, where the more pointed part of it was facing in the opposite direction, and we were seeing the rear end of it. And it was hovering and turning around and then started moving upward vertically into the sky until it disappeared into the blue at a far distance. And that's the short of the story. And so that was the only time I've ever had a UFO encounter in my life. I mean, it was very startling. My wife was sitting with some other people at another table, and I didn't know that anybody saw it but me. I was looking around, and nobody was reacting. And then on our way home from the party, I brought it up to my wife, and she said she saw it. She said that she saw it too, and both of us noticed that nobody else reacted. And basically, before we left, I asked the people at my table, I said, did you see that that black triangular or boomerang-shaped craft? And like I said, it was more boomerang. It was not triangular. And so it was a boomerang-shaped craft. And I said, did you guys see that thing with the bright lights coming on? It was just black, and then all of a sudden the lights came on, and it just started going upward. And everybody looked at me funny, and they just kind of just went on about their conversation. I think I got a no, we didn't see anything type mumbling. So then long story short, I'm working in South Korea at the 8th Fighter Wing in Kunsan, where I'm stationed. I'm working as a faculty member of the University of Maryland's overseas program, and I'm basically teaching physical sciences, mathematics, and computer sciences, and doing some intelligence work for the Air Force under a University of Maryland contract to the Pacific Air Force. And so I'm out there, and I finished my first year under the contract, and I don't like the fact that they didn't have any summer work for me, and that would be a disaster for our family's income. So I came home for the summer, and I started looking for another job. I had 4 years on my contract, or 3 years left, I mean. And I was looking for another job, and I'm thumbing through Physics Today's job ads, and there's this interesting ad from the National Institute for Discovery Science, and I don't remember the words of it now. I may still have it in my file somewhere. But anyway, it was an ad about talking about exploring the universe, consciousness, looking at the physics of unusual phenomenon, and that sort of appealed to me. So I said, well, you know, this is in Las Vegas. My dad and stepmom have lived in Las Vegas since 1968 when they moved there after they got married. And then my half-brother and half-sister were born and raised there. And my wife was born and partly raised in Las Vegas. So I've got Las Vegas connections going back to 68 as a child. And so I applied for the job. And the next thing I know, I get a call from out of the blue from Colonel John Alexander. And you know John Alexander. And,
I do.
So John interviews me on the phone. And he said that my CV looks very similar to one of the members of the Science Advisory Board who's got a background very close to mine, and he thinks that that Science Advisory Board member and I would get along really well. He was talking about Hal Puthoff. And so then he said he was going to talk to Bob Bigelow, and he asked me if I knew who that was, and I didn't, of course. My dad knew who that was because my dad was the secretary-treasurer of the New and Used Car Dealers Association in Las Vegas for decades. So he was running McCallum's International Trucks for the first 17 years. Then he worked for Fletcher Jones in an interim, and then he ended up at Pete Cabina's Desert Chrysler Plymouth over on Boulder Highway. And so my dad knew Bob and Diane Bigelow, and he had seen them at many of the Las Vegas business functions and social affairs, social events, and gatherings, et cetera. So anyway, the long story short is that John gave my CV to Bigelow, and he said, John told me that my CV went from the bottom of a high stack to the top of the stack, and the next thing I know, a couple days later, or the next day, it was Bob Bigelow called me, and he interviewed me on the phone for a couple hours, and he flew me out to Las Vegas the next month, and he interviewed me in person, and then he hired me on the spot, and that was in early July of 1996, and the rest is history. as we
you end up, you end up studying UFOs, animal mutilations. You spend some time on the Utah Ranch. It's otherwise known as a UFO ranch, Skinwalker Ranch. Yep. And then you had some experiences. You saw some things there. It later it becomes a focus of the Bass study as well. You can't get away from that ranch.
Yeah, so basically I'm there just a month, and the next thing we know, we hear about Skinwalker Ranch. And I don't know whether it's a good idea to reveal the ranch owner's name. His name has been in the press in Utah before, but I'll keep it under wraps for now because I don't know if it's appropriate to even mention it.
Yeah, it's not public, I don't think so. Yeah.
Say again?
I don't think it's public, so.
Yeah, okay. Well, remember, Zach Bennett wrote articles in the Deseret newspaper about him. But anyway, let's move on. So the point is the next thing I know is a month later, the ranch came up, and Bob Bigelow called the NID staff. By that time, Colin Kelleher had been hired on, George Onet had been hired on, and John Alexander had been working for Bob since 95, I think, when NIDS first opened for business during that summer of 95, August maybe, or a little earlier. And so we all got called in, and we talked about the ranch, and Bob was telling us that he's buying it. And he's going out there to investigate. And I think he took John Alexander and a few others with him on a couple of trips. And the short of that is he bought the ranch by the end of August, I think. And so the next thing I know is in September begins my first of nearly 6 years of field trips out to that ranch. In the first year or so, we were making about 2 week trips to the ranch out of every month. And then it slowed down to about a week out of every month. And then after a couple of years, everybody was kind of getting tired of that cycle, so we started trading off with other people taking shifts to go out there and whatnot. And I was the last one with one of our investigators named Roger Pinson to go out to the ranch in August of 2001, and that was our very last trip. Because in about the 2000 to 2001 period, the phenomenon was dying off. There just wasn't anything going on at the ranch anymore. And it was getting quieter and quieter and quieter. So we were turning our attention at that time to the other communities in Utah, up out to about 50 to 100 miles away from the ranch, where we would go and investigate Bigfoot sighting reports or UFO reports or whatnot, or anomalous objects that have been found falling from the sky in conjunction with the UFO sighting and so forth. And so, and an alien abduction. So we started investigating these cases and whatnot. And Bob Bigelow made the decision in August of 2001 that we would cease going out there because we were not getting very productive data and because just nothing was happening. So I experienced a lot of the phenomenon that you and Colin documented in your book, Hunt for the Skinwalker. And it was very startling. For a guy like me, I only had a UFO sighting with my wife at a party in the middle of the day. And here I'm experiencing paranormal phenomenon and UFO craft, and it was quite a challenge, to say the least. It's like, well, how do you put this to science? And the answer I came to the conclusion of later on with my colleague Jacques Belli, who was also a member of the Science Advisory Board. Basically, this is not a scientific. This is not a natural phenomenon. So you're really hard pressed to put the scientific method on it. You can put forensic science on it, but what it really is an intelligence matter, because this is a phenomenon that's under intelligent control. It's transient. It's not repeatable. It occurs when it occurs because it's intelligent and it's interacting with humans. And so it's not. And yes, you can put up scientific instrument and try to measure it, try to capture it in a lucky moment. But as you know from your book, we had trouble with the instruments being able to capture anything, especially when they're being pet, like one of the surveillance cameras on the property, in full view of another surveillance camera in broad daylight, having its cable cut, and that affected camera went offline. And yet, from the view of the other working camera, nobody was there cutting that cable. Whatever it was invisible.
Is there anything you can say about the Bass study of the ranch? I know the NIDS period is what we documented in the book, but not much has been known or made public about what Bass did on the property. I'm not sure if that's part of classified or unclassified reports, but is there anything you can say about what, if anything, was learned?
I only heard verbally about elements of the Bass report. We were getting such a volume of reports that Hal was putting them in the library, and I never sat down and had the time to read through them. I basically just got briefings over, from him verbally on what, that would summarize what we were learning. Or we would hear from Colin Kelleher. He would tell us some of the stuff. Basically, they were having a lot of phenomena out there. It had been heating up. So sometime after NITS closed in 2004, there was some period after that year that things started heating up. And during the Bass period, or just before the Bass period, actually, I think it was, before, right around 2007 and later, phenomenon was being apparent, and it was being witnessed. And so the Big Bear Aerospace Ranch security folks were tasked with writing reports. I mean, diligently going out and casing the property, looking for anything to make sure there's nothing out of place, or, no, there's no intruders who shouldn't be there. And they're encountering phenomenon. I do know that there had been some phenomenon witnessed by the ranch security. I don't recall specifics. I'm not that good with that particular subject because I didn't spend time reading through the reports, and we still have them here. And
let me ask you this, Eric. We got about 2 minutes left. The UFO study, the Pentagon study, ended 2011, 2012. There are different reports on that. The funding was cut off, and if you hear anonymous sources from the Pentagon, they'll tell reporters, we didn't learn anything. They produced a bunch of reports, but really we cut off the money because they weren't really doing anything. Is there something that you think was worthwhile about it, and should a study of this kind be ongoing?
Yeah, that was the jaded opinion or the uninformed opinion of whoever it was that said those things. Essentially, that was a high-value program. The initial congressional appropriation ran out in 2012. The program continued under internal funding in Louise's office to the present, and it's still going on with the new man in charge who took over for Louise after he left the Pentagon last October, I think it was. And so basically, the program is still operating under their own funding, internal funding. They don't need congressional appropriation for it because there's already dedicated monies for things like this. So they did produce reports. They have seen Tic Tacs. They've got data fusion analysis. They have some internal analysts that they've been giving this to, and I am not privy or in the chain of custody of the data analysis, so I don't know what it all is. And so when I don't have an active contract to them, so that means that my security clearances are on hibernation until I get a new contract. So that means I don't have any access to the information. But I do know that they're still going. They're still getting data. They're still interviewing pilots, still interviewing non-pilot military personnel who also man weapon platforms of all kinds, like surface warships and subs and Army and Marine Corps ground stations and things like that. So they're still...
Well, that's good to know. Dr. Eric Davis, I think we just broke some news there. It's still ongoing in some capacity. I hope that you can come back soon and we can get into more details about this. And I hope there's a more formal resumption of the program. Thanks for being here. We really appreciate it, Eric, and I'll talk to you again.
You're welcome. Happy to be here.
All right. And coming up next, Dr. Hal Puthoff from the Institute of Advanced Studies. We're going to drill down a little bit into the USS Nimitz video that so many people have seen and other aspects of the Pentagon UFO study. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. Back in October, the world was sort of stunned to see these two UFO videos recorded by the Pentagon, or it came out of the Pentagon. Whether it's an official release or not is somewhat in question. It certainly is official video in that it was recorded by the U.S. military. One of those UFO videos, the so-called Tic Tac UFO, was recorded by warplanes attached to the USS Nimitz group off the coast of Southern California. The other UFO video, the so-called Gimbal video, is of unknown origin. I think a lot of people have assumed it had something to do with the USS Nimitz and was recorded by the same outfit. It was not. In this hour, we're going to get down to the bottom line on those two videos with someone who has analyzed them, who has seen them in and out, and who knows what they mean and what they don't mean. His name is Dr. Hal Puthoff, the director of the Institute for Advanced Studies in Austin. His research interests range from theoretical studies of gravitation, cosmology, energy research. He was with Stanford Research International, has worked for the National Security Agency as a consultant to CIA and studying remote viewing, works with NASA and its Breakthrough Propulsion Physics Initiative. As I mentioned in the first hour, he was also involved with the National Institute for Discovery Science and with BASS, and was a consultant to the ATIP, Pentagon UFO Study. He is now with the To the Stars Academy that was founded by Tom DeLonge, and Dr. Puthoff joins us in just a moment. Stick around. Well, I've been waiting for this for a long time. Dr. Hal Puthoff, welcome to Coast to Coast.
George, it's a pleasure to be here.
You know, I read off just a little synopsis of your background. You are, you know, you have such solid scientific credentials. You're considered a brilliant guy by colleagues all over the world. You published all these papers. I think you've been nominated for a Nobel Prize at least twice, and yet you sort of risk it all in the pursuit of what some would call fringe topics, crazy subjects. Give me some kind of an idea about how you got to this point that you would be associated with folks chasing UFOs.
Well, certainly it was kind of a squirrely path to get from there to here. But anyway, as part of my work at Stanford, I worked on lasers and quantum electronics and so on, even co-authored a textbook that was published in English, Russian, French, and Chinese. So here I'd launched my really terrific career in lasers and quantum electronics, but it turned out that as part of my graduate school, I had a stint as a naval intelligence officer with the National Security Agency. And so it turns out that plays a key role later. And so eventually, when I left Stanford University and went to SRI International to do laser research and so on, it turned out that just on a lark, I ended up doing a little ESP or PK experiment with Ingo Swann, who's a very talented kind of guy. And I distributed that around, and pretty soon the CIA landed on my doorstep. And it turned out that they were concerned that the Russians were putting millions of dollars for over a decade into the area of ESP research. No scientists in America even thought there was such a thing. And they looked into my background, so I had all these security clearances at NSA. I was at SRI that had lots of black programs anyway, and I was a hard scientist, physicist, and that's what they thought they needed. Would I mind taking a look to see if there's anything to this stuff? And actually, the truth of the matter is they were hoping that I would basically find out it's all nonsense, so they didn't have to worry about it and they could close the books. Well, as your listeners would know, that eventually turned into a $20 million project program, known popularly toward the end as Project Stargate. And so it was in that process of doing those experiments that I began to realize there's a lot more to our scientific or worldview than we usually give it credit for. And I have to admit that even throughout that program, every time I would go in to do an experiment of the remote viewing type, as we called it, I would ask myself, what am I doing here? I'm a physicist. This can't possibly work. And then we get another terrific result. So based on that, I just got greened, I guess you'd say, by the situation. And so even when I left the SRI to take up being president and CEO of EarthTech International, with its academic arm, Institute for Advanced Studies in Austin, I was basically greened to these kinds of things. And so when John Alexander, for example, came along and asked me to join his UFO working group, I did do that. And through the connection with John, I ended up being on the science advisory board of Robert Bigelow's NIDS, National Institute for Discovery Science, that
you covered pretty thoroughly in the first hour. And so, of course, as part of that, I saw many things, and the truth of the matter is most of them we never did get to a point that we could explain. And so it was along this period that, as it turns out, people at DIA, as analysts at DIA, decided that they wanted to investigate the kind of stuff that was happening on the ranch, but primarily, really, the UFO aspect. And so they approached Senator Reid, and he thought it was a good idea and collected his other two senator colleagues, Stevens from Alaska and Dan Inouye from
Hawaii.
And they're all part of the special access program, black money kinds of research. And so I was asked, because I was already known to Bob Bigelow, if I would help respond to the request. Now, a lot of people say, okay, well, this is just some kind of sweetheart deal between Reid and Bigelow, both being from Nevada and so on. Truth of the matter is, there was a broad area announcement out of DIA. Any aerospace corporation could apply for the bid, for the grant, but it turned out that Bigelow got it. And so that's how I suddenly ended up being immersed in what we now call the ATIP program.
$22 million over the period of time. Some people say it went from 2007 to 2012. Some say it's 2008 to 2011. Still, in Pentagon terms, it's not a lot of money, is it?
That's not a lot of money. And usually programs that do require a lot of money are programs that have a lot of build out of equipment or a lot of personnel and so on. But basically, this was an analytical group to evaluate data, to collect data and evaluate it. So it was primarily personnel costs that went into it, although it's also true that Bigelow was asked to put some special buildings together with high security to begin to store materials that would be coming along as part of the program. So, but it's not a lot of money, I have to admit.
You have so you worked for the NSA for a while. You were a consultant to CIA. You're with Bob Bigelow and NIDS, and they always, whenever I read Bob Bigelow's name in some UFO publication, they attach the word shadowy to it, the shadowy Bob Bigelow. Then you write an RFP that goes to the DIA, and then back in October, you're standing on a stage with Tom DeLonge and other principals of To the Stars. Tom, of course, has taken a lot of heat and lumps. And I'm just wondering, that makes you part of the cabal, doesn't it?
It does sound like I'm part of the cabal, doesn't it? And certainly, I can actually understand how it is that your average onlooker out there in the UFO field would come to that conclusion, because after all, they see suddenly this collaboration emerging for a new startup, the To the Stars Academy of Arts and Science. It involves Lou Elizondo, who just left as being the program director of the ATIP program in the Pentagon. And then you've got Chris Mellon, former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Intelligence, Jim Semivan, who's a high-level fellow out of the DDO. You've got Steve Justice, longtime program director at the Skunk Works, and myself with decades involvement in CIA, DIA, and as a contractor and so on. And so I can imagine that people look at that setup and say, okay, this has got to be some kind of massive conspiracy. This must have been in the plans for forever. And it's trying to pull the American public along in some direction concerning belief and so on. Truth of the matter is, the people on this list all have had high access, of course. And the point is that having that high access put us in a position, one by one, to recognize that the subject area was not being handled as effectively and efficiently as it could, that it's all locked up in various kinds of stovepipe situations, I mean, just to give you a perfect example, these videos that have come out where everyone is looking at them and analyzing them and so on, I mean, those videos were there in the Pentagon, and what could they do to get additional help to evaluate them? It really wasn't a way to do that. And so the idea that we would come together and form a public benefit corporation, as we call it, in order to begin to get this, put some sunshine on this area and get it out to where it's no longer a subject of ridicule, hopefully, but rather something that people can take part in and see results being made. And so it's a cabal in the best sense, I would say, and that is we're taking the knowledge and information and results we know, and to the degree that any of it can be made public because it's not classified, and further work that can be done that's not classified, this can become part of the societal's public discussion. So it's just the opposite, really, of the people who would say, you know, this is some giant cabal that they worked on poor Lou Elizondo and finally pushed him out the door to be a lightning rod for all kinds of conspiracy theories. No, it was just the opposite. These are all hardworking people, all people who, one way or another, ran across this subject area and knew there was a lot to it, actually, and has been over the years. And there's been difficulty in figuring out how to do with it. Why is that? Well, in this subject area, even inside the government, what do you have to deal with? You've got fear, you've got careerism, you've got incompetence, you've even got fundamental religious views saying this is not an area that American taxpayer money should be spent on. That set of comments came from Colm Kelleher, who was Bob Bigelow's basically deputy manager for the ATIP program. And he's right. Those are the kind of things we always ran into. So despite the fact that there was funding and work was getting done and it was getting done professionally, nonetheless, we had to brief other groups. We had to try to set up programs in other areas. And we ran into all kinds of problems. So I think this giant step that we took to come out from behind the curtain, so to speak, and set up something that the public can have access to and participate in, that was really a step in the right direction.
You know, I don't have a security clearance, so I'm just basing this on what I've picked up over the years. But my sense of it is military would have these encounters with unknown aerial objects from some place else that could perform these incredible maneuvers. A report is made, it goes somewhere, it gets stuck in a drawer, that there's no central body that analyzes this stuff. It does no one any good to make too much of a big fuss over it. So, for example, like with the USS Nimitz incident, that happened in 2004. Those videos were recorded, they went somewhere, and no one did anything with it until Bass and ATIP and you guys came along.
That's exactly the case. And one of the nice things that we've arranged to do on the To the Stars website, we have a link to something called COI, Community of Interest. And tapping on that link, you can get to the videos, as you've already seen them in, say, the New York Times or whatever. But in addition, we have all the documentation. It was arranged in advance before those videos left the Pentagon that they went through massive review, typical of releasing previously classified information. And all the chain of custody taking place as the videos were transferred out, all that information is there. So it's possible to get a complete rundown. So rather than just being a video that, what the heck, you know, it might have just shown up on the internet someplace. In this case, they have a complete chain of custody and a lot of detail, you know, describing even the Raytheon FLIR systems, forward of looking infrared radar systems, used to gather the data. And so I think that's a step in the right direction.
So is this an official release? I mean, someone had to green light that. Yes, it could be released.
That's right. I mean, it was released out of the element that Luis Elizondo was in charge of, and he was the authority there for how to deal with that information. And, of course, as part of the long-ranging ATIP program, he archived all this material and so on. But there it was. I mean, there was some analysis going on in-house. I mean, in addition to the DOD and the Pentagon, we had Navy and CIA people were involved in analyses. But nonetheless, not as much as what really needs to be done. And so that was the idea in setting up this startup to the STARS Academy of Arts and Science, to set up a situation and assuming we can get the funding to be able to carry out these kind of analyses in great detail.
Let's talk about, we'll go to a break in about 3 minutes. I think that might be enough time to talk about the Tic Tac video, the USS Nimitz video. What can you tell us about that? You know, we've seen amateur experts online saying it's a bug on a windshield, or it's a lens flare, or it's the sound of a vacuum cleaner or a lawnmower. What can you tell us about why you were impressed by that video?
Well, primarily because it isn't just the video. I mean, that's what most people have had access to and are attempting to analyze and come up with alternatives, like, well, it's just a jet in the distance, because that also makes infrared spots that can be detected and so on. But the full data on the Nimitz involves radar tracking this object coming in from 60,000 feet, dropping down to 50 feet in a matter of seconds. There are the radar records of that. And then you've got the pilots. Dave Fravor has given interviews on this. You can find it all over the internet and also on the To the Stars Academy website, where he actually got into what you might almost call a dogfight with it. And that is, he circled around it and it circled around him, and they got very close. I mean, this is nose to nose. And so in that situation, you could tell exactly the size of it, about 46 feet across. And so he could see the acceleration that it could accomplish. I mean, in that very incident, for example, although they were supposed to be doing an exercise at some point, they had been rerouted to check this thing out. And then after the thing took off, the radar operator said, well, this thing, whatever it is, has gone to the place where you're supposed to have your training thing. Well, I mean, it was miles and miles away, and it got there in a few seconds, and no sonic boom. I mean, so there's so much data well beyond just the videotapes, all integrated together, and that's what makes this kind of observation absolutely spectacular kind of thing.
Well, there's also the gimbal video, which we're going to ask you to analyze, and then there are promises of other videos, and I want to know if you've seen those as well. We were talking with Dr. Hal Putoff about the Tic Tac video, the gimbal video, UFO studies by Bass and the Pentagon, and much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. Dr. Hal Putoff from the Institute for Advanced Studies in Austin. We're talking about the Pentagon's UFO study, conducted through the auspices of a private company, Bass, founded by Robert Bigelow. And if you've been listening, you know we're talking about the Tic Tac video. Big question is, how does this work? Did we figure out how these objects can make these kind of leaps and fly circles around our most advanced weapon systems and platforms? And what about that gimbal video that was also released by the Pentagon? And will we eventually see other videos that have been released? Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. Hal Putoff, we all saw the Tic Tac video, the USS Nimitz battle group. How do we know it's not the Russians or the Chinese or us, some other classified program that not everyone has been told about?
Well, we don't absolutely rule that out. the twofold nature of the threat as far as the ATIP program goes was specified very specifically. One is there a current threat from this phenomena? Could be a foreign derivation, could be off-world, but nonetheless, it's obviously being deployed and tested, including in our country. And then there's the future threat, which is really concerning, and that is potential terrestrial adversaries achieving significant breakthroughs in the development of game-changing disruptive technologies based on evaluation of the UAP phenomena from sensor data or crash-retrieved materials. So our best analysts, and based on the intelligence information we have so far, we've not been able to track it back to Russian or Chinese. Is there some other terrestrial society off the grid? I mean, everything is on the table because we're strictly only going to pay attention to what we can observe and what we can prove. And so basically, looking at the characteristics and matching them up against what we know of our special systems and other foreign adversary systems, it just doesn't seem to match anything that we know about. Now, that's not to say that we can't make progress in trying to figure out how this works. In fact, a large part of my own activity in this program was to go through the physics, as Eric described. I commissioned 38 papers to give us the best physics in all kinds of new areas like metallic glasses or plasma propulsion or whatever. There was a model that came to the fore that I explored in some detail, which I think has some merit, and that is what we call space-time metric engineering. And that is when you look at the effects that are associated, rapid accelerations, the changes of direction instantly, the ability to hover, all these things, as wild as they are, the truth of the matter is, if you take general relativity equations and write them down one side of a piece of paper, and then you write down all of the oddball observations on the other side of the piece of paper, you can get a reasonable match between them. So that sounds good. The problem is, though, what it would take in the general relativistic physics that we know and love at the present time is we just don't have the energy densities that could possibly create those effects. So that makes me, from a physicist standpoint, extremely skeptical that this is something that we have in the back room or the Russians or the Chinese have.
You know, the word threat in the ATIP title has a lot of people upset. These are our friendly space brothers. They're no threat to us. They haven't attacked us. They haven't wiped out cities. The threat that you see, though, is that the Russians and Chinese could be studying this and figure this out and get this technology ahead of us. When I talked to Senator Reid late last year, he had said that he thought, and I'm not sure what his sources are, that he thought the Russians and Chinese were studying this stuff. We were studying it for a while and then stopped.
Yeah, there's absolutely no doubt that they're studying them. I've read detailed classified documents on the Russian work. The military equivalents around the world are all concerned about this for the very same reasons. The Russians would be worried that we could reverse engineer it if we got some technology under our fingertips. So that's definitely a major issue. So there's no getting around it. This is taken seriously. It has to be considered a threat. Now, are there any indications? Well, it's true that we haven't had any obvious hostile attack. On the other hand, it's also the case, as Harry Reifack mentioned in an interview with you, that these craft have infiltrated our missile silos, our nuclear missile silos, and have on occasion taken them offline. once or twice, could be some kind of coincidence. But there's a whole northern tier where this happened at base after base after base. And it turns out the same thing has happened in Russia as well. And so you have two ways of interpreting it. One is that they're just checking out that they know how to stop it if we get too frisky here, and therefore that'd be a nice, benign interpretation. On the other hand, if there's some thought that eventually there will be some hostile interaction between us, then they might be wanting to check that they can be sure to take out our nuclear missile silo. So from the standpoint of the Pentagon, whereas all the other people out there can kind of speculate that it might be this, it might be that, and they hope it's this, and they hope it's that, in the Pentagon and in the intelligence communities, you can only work to determine what actually is the facts. And in the absence of data to the contrary or proof to the contrary, you have to assume that there could be a threat aspect, whether from the phenomenon itself or, as we've already discussed, from a potential adversary making game-changing disruptive technology based on their evaluations.
I had heard, and I'm not sure if it's public or if it's true, but I had heard that there were multiple incidents and encounters with tic-tac-type technology, that the increasing frequency is sort of one of the things that convinced Luis Elizondo to leave the Pentagon to go join To the Stars Academy and to work on this problem.
That's exactly right. though you hear that the program may have shut down in 2012 or whatever, the truth of the matter is tic-tac incidents off the east coast of the United States that have interfered with our air flight plans and activities. I mean, it's absolutely an unbelievable rush of that kind of phenomena happening. And so even in the gimbal video, even though in the gimbal video you only see a given craft, when you dig down into the details, which you can do if you go to the community of interest link on the To the Stars Academy of Arts and Science, it turns out that in the verbal transcripts that are presented, they see on their larger radar sites, while they're getting a nice red picture of the gimbal that they're watching, that there's a whole fleet of them. I mean, quite a number of them, all flying around. So it's not just kind of a one-off phenomena. And it seems to be happening as massively these days as ever.
The gimbal video is not the same as the Tic Tac 2004 incident. It shows an
right.
object that it's seems not. To have a field around it. Do you know what that field is?
Don't know. Basically, on the FLIR, what you're seeing is basically a temperature distribution. And so it could simply be that it's heat or it's cold compared to the heat of the object. So we don't have any idea. But basically what that FLIR device picks up is basically the temperature distribution. So we know it has something to do with the temperature, but beyond that, there's no way to interpret it as some kind of electromagnetic aura or whatever.
Tom DeLonge and Luis Elizondo have made public statements about other videos, as many as two dozen, that have already come out of the Pentagon. Have you seen them, and do you know what the plans are for their eventual release?
I've seen one additional one that we're planning on getting out relatively soon. It's certainly an interesting video. You see watching this thing and zeroed in just like on these other two videos. Then at some point it just takes off like a shot. I mean, it's sort of unreal if you talk to the pilots about it. And there are other videos that I'm told, but I haven't looked at any.
So what is the eventual plan? And the study is done. The BASS part of the study is done. People are still collecting information, according to you and Eric Davis. Is there some more formal program underway? Is it some of this going to be funneled to the STARS to analyze and evaluate and figure out?
The program in the Pentagon is certainly continuing. I think there's a fair chance that it will continue at an accelerated pace. And to the degree that this sort of community of interest thing can be set up to work, we anticipate seeing cooperation and collaboration with possibly the Pentagon directly or with other aerospace corporations who get involved that we would be subcontractors to. So there's a lot going on behind the scenes to set up new funding organizations and so on. People have complained, well, why is To the STARS sort of not going anywhere very fast? Well, the truth of the matter is, for what we want to do, it needs funding. And so raising the money, the sort of crowdfunding approach is works to a certain degree, but to really to get a robust technical organization going, because the reason I joined and the reason Steve Justice joined from the Skunk Works is that we don't want to see this just as a PR kind of thing, getting information out to the public, although that's a major piece of it. We also want to see and get started various technical projects and programs that take advantage of some of the information that's been learned. A lot of the data within the BASS program is archived in a tremendous amount of materials you can possibly believe. Bob Bigelow had something like 46 people working there, putting all this stuff together. I mean, just to give you one example, we looked at Clarice Island, Brazil case, 1977, 1978, hundreds of UAVs observed by civilians in the Brazilian Air Force investigative team called Operation Plate. They got more than 1,000 pages of documents, logs, sketches, and maps, more than 500 photographs, greater than 15 hours of motion film, measured a lot of physiological effects and medical injuries, and so put together a whole database of all of that. Eventually, a lot of that material, this is part of the hope as the To the STARS moves forward, is that we will be able to arrange on a case-by-case basis, study-by-study basis, to possibly release some of this material. At the present time, it's Bigelow proprietary, as it should be, and so there will be negotiation over attempting to put some of that data out. So that's
well, a lot of people have filed requests through FOIA. I'm one of them. You mentioned the scenario where maybe the Russians or Chinese learn something based on a crash. One of the most intriguing sentences in the New York Times report mentioned an exotic material of unknown origin that was at Bigelow Aerospace for a while. Is that from a crash? Do you think crashes have happened? Or can you say?
Detailed proof that crashes have happened would be still a highly classified piece of data.
Well, that's an answer of sorts.
Yeah, there has been one leaked document. How it got leaked, I'll never know. Which is out there that talks about some crashes that we were able to verify what was a real document. So my opinion is that there are probably at least materials. Now, it wouldn't necessarily have to be crash of an entire craft, but it could be a piece blown off in whatever by a lightning strike or a missile or whatever. So I'm not surprised to find out that there's discussion of material being available. we've had an opportunity to look at some unusual material, and so I think that's a big area that will become more significant as time goes on.
I you're killing me, Hal. You had a chance to look at some material?
I did. And the interesting thing about it was that couldn't figure out a very complex material. When you talk to people that are doing this kind of research, you find out, you know, it isn't that, you know, all the elements in the periodic table we know about. So you're not finding some new element that you didn't realize is in the periodic table. No, it's more like putting together layers of various kinds of material that you wouldn't expect to be able to be layered, and that the result at the end of the day is that it has certain unusual characteristics that you wouldn't have predicted in advance. So that's the kind of thing that to a physicist is the most interesting.
You know, the first time I met you, we were on a flight to go meet Philip Corso. It was before his book came out, before the world heard from him, and he was talking about something he had learned at the Pentagon about how alien technology was engineered, atoms at a time. I don't know if it's this material you're talking about fits with that, but it's amazing that it's come full circle, sort of.
Yeah, that's the kind of thing. So it'll probably be some time before we really learn a lot about materials, or even if we figure them out, how to make them. And they can be very, you know, I mean, let's face it, even, 10 years ago, no one would have thought of making graphene or whatever. I mean, so our own science is coming up to speed pretty rapidly. And so that means that if there are materials available, then as time goes on, with our increased acuity in examining materials and evaluating them, you know, we'll probably learn more as time goes on if more materials become available.
Dr. Hal Puthoff, can't thank you enough for being with us. I hope you'll come back. There's so much more to talk about. And I basically, if we've learned one thing, it's that this deserves to be studied. And if we don't study it and figure it out, someone else will, right?
That's certainly the case.
All right. Look forward to whatever comes next from To the Stars Academy. I'll be watching it. Thank you, Hal. Appreciate it for being here.
Okay. Thanks, George, for having me on.